you get to do death investigation. You get to work with police. You get to understand what's going on at the crime scenes. And then you get to do the examinations that required on the bodies and then go to court and testify. And so between all that, it's one of those jobs where when you come in the morning, you have no idea, you know, what you're going to be doing or how much of it you're going to be doing, or, you know, whether or not you're going to have a night's worth of sleep or you're going to be out all night at a crime scene helping the police collect evidence and examine the body. That's the interesting part. It's least understood simply because there are not many medical school programs that even talk about forensic pathology. Some of them will do it in passing. SIU was fortunate that we had Dr. Grant Johnson, who was there when I was doing my education, and he did a lot of the forensic pathology for the local sheriff and the city police. And so as a result, he introduced us to it a little bit during our course training at SIU in pathology. But even at that, you know, it's really in most universities and medical schools not even talked about.
I saw that you mentioned you were the first person in your family to go to college, let alone become a doctor. Why did you decide to go the pathology route?
True confessions. When I started SIU was really set up when I was going there to make family practice doctors for Southern Illinois. That was kind of their goal, was to help populate Southern Illinois with physicians because there was such a shortage there. And so when I went to SIU, my thought was that I was going to be a family practice doc. Unfortunately, once I got there and started doing all of my rotations through the different disciplines of medicine, I kind of realized that I really did not like dealing with sick patients all that much. But as I was going through my second year of medical school, I really liked pathology. I really thought it was an interesting field. You don't have to deal directly with patients all that much. I thought that would be a good alternative for me to be able to practice medicine, but at the same time, not have to deal with patient personalities all day long.
And you write about how TV has changed the way people think of forensic pathology. Can you tell us a little bit about if that education that it's offered has been an accurate depiction, or just in general, how it's changed the field for people who are actually on the job?
I tell people when they ask me, which one of these TV shows best fits what you do? The best representation of what I actually did was Dr. Mallard from NCIS. Ducky, he shows that he's a part of a team that investigates and uses the autopsy examination as part of the investigation and a tool to come up with an answer. Pathology, forensic pathology, does not solve that many crimes. All it does is it produces evidence that the investigative officer can use to either prove or disprove that someone was involved in the crime. So that it gets a lot of the publicity because of TV and that, but it's really the gumshoe investigator who goes out and talks to people and does the interviews and the scene investigations that really solves the crime. And we're just kind of there to make sure that he has enough physical evidence to make it stick.
This is Illinois Edition. I'm Rachel Otwell. I'm joined on the phone by Dr. Gary Cumberland. He is a native of East St. Louis, Illinois. He went on to work in Mobile, Alabama and Pensacola, Florida as a pathologist. He was educated by SIU, and he will be speaking at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine at the Springfield campus at 6 p.m. on Wednesday. He'll be talking about the differences between coroners and medical examiners, as well as other facets of his career. And that's all covered in his book, which is called My Life with Death. And one thing in the book, it kind of starts with a case we talk about, which was something that was new to me, this idea we already know about sudden infant death that happens for newborns. But this happens as well with adults, where you have had cases where you just can't find any explanation for a cause of death for someone.
There are a small group of cases where, regardless of how hard we look, we cannot find an anatomic reason for the person to have died. Usually you can find something, you know, that caused them to go into a bad physiologic state that just, you know, ended in death. But there's a small set of cases that it's almost as though there's a part of our nervous system we call the autonomic nervous system, which is kind of really means automatic. It just takes care of things without us having to think about it, that controls our heart rate and our breathing. That for some reason in individuals, that just stops working. And so as a result, they'll die like a SIDS case or crib death where they just stop breathing. And no one knows why that occurred. I think in the book, I start out by talking about a case that really kind of overcast my whole career, because that was exactly what happened. It was a young woman who was absolutely in perfect health, you know, no drug use, no nothing. All the toxicology was completely clean, and she died in her sleep. And she was under a lot of stress at work, but still, you know, she was a good, you know, everyone loved her. She was, you know, just a good hard worker. Her parents loved her. She stayed at home, but she just went to bed and died. And so then when you have those type of cases, you've got to look at the parents and say, I don't know why she died. And that's not a very satisfying answer, because, you know, she had younger sisters who are growing up who would like to know if there's something running in the family, you know, that they need to be aware of so that they can do some preventative measures. In that case, you know, there's just no explanation for why they died.
And so the book is full of stories like this one. I was wondering if there were any other, you know, a case that maybe it was surprising for you or was able to give you some sort of insight you hadn't had before.
Probably in the book, the most interesting case that I had was I was involved in the execution of John Lewis Evans back in the early 80s. He was a guy who had been convicted of killing a pawn shop owner in Mobile and had gone to prison, you know, had requested that he not have any of the appeals put in place because he, you know, he had become a Christian and he just wanted to pay for what he did and was willing to accept the price, the penalty for that. This was the first execution that Alabama had done within 20 years because the Supreme Court had overturned all the capital punishment laws and said that they were cruel and unusual punishment, so they had to be rewritten. So like everything else in the government, takes a while for all that to occur. And so there was about a 15 to 20 year period where there were no executions, plenty of people on death row in Alabama, but no one being executed. So John Lewis Evans was the first one to be executed after they had developed their new capital punishment law. And so the guys who were running the electric chair they had never had any experience running it before. All the guys who had run it before had retired or had died. And so here were a bunch of men who were trying to figure out how to run this electric chair. They didn't quite understand the process. So it ended up being a public relations disaster for the state of Alabama because there were a lot of burning and charring of the body that occurred and a lot of people throwing up their hands. And so that was the thing that kind of got me interested in electrical deaths. And I could use that as an example to kind of to show myself how people die with various levels of electricity. And how the death occurred in such a way that John Lewis Evans didn't suffer at all. He was dead instantaneously. It was the people who had to witness the execution who were the ones who really suffered because of the shock that they had just watching everything as it occurred.
And finally, I'm just curious how, you know, for the average person having a field of work where you're surrounded by death on a regular basis, probably doesn't sound like something that's all that manageable. How do you think it has shaped your own perspective on life and death?
It made me realize that it's inevitable and unpredictable, that's for sure. Forensic pathologists or medical examiners, they tend, as they get later in their career, to either retire early, go off and do something else, become administrators rather than doing the day-to-day work in the autopsy room. Because, I mean, there's a limit to how many fatally abused children you can autopsy and not have it start affecting, you know, the way you think about things. And so I found that happening in my life, too, is I had to be very much on guard, you know, that I didn't let this bother me. I had to learn how to compartmentalize that part of my life totally separate from the life I had with my family and my own children growing up. It's like, you know, when you're doing an autopsy on a child that died of crib death or SIDS, and you've got a daughter at home in the crib who's exactly the same age as that young child that you're autopsying, it really makes you stop and think. And it can be depressing if you're not very careful and put up mechanisms to protect yourself as you go through your career.